We are recording.
I'm just going to read a little bit here.
It's 11 o'clock on a Tuesday. The calendar date's March 31st, 2015. On this tape, you'll hear stories of Charles Schaefer. That's S-C-H-A-F-E-R. I'm Keith Sweet, and we're taping this interview in Sutter Creek. Charles, thanks for participating in the Amador County Living History Project. We appreciate your willingness to preserve our county's history by sharing your memories. This conversation is being tape recorded, and the tapes will be made available to the public without charge. If you share something during the next hour that you regret saying on the tape, we'll make every effort to remove it before we publicize it. Anyway, Charles, thanks for having me.
Sure thing.
We'll put that microphone right there so that you have kind of a soft voice.
I can raise it if I need
okay,
to.
Okay, there we go. We were talking earlier before we began taping about your family's history. Why don't we just start with, I guess it would be your maternal grandmother that came mm-hmm. from Europe somewhere?
They came from England. I'm not sure exactly where in England. I know, but I just can't remember right now.
Sure.
They came from England, I believe, in the 1850s or 1860s and settled in Nebraska. Western Nebraska in the Kimball area.
And what was her name?
Wilkinson. Trying to think of her husband's name, but I can't right offhand.
No problem. And her first name?
Anna.
Anna Wilkinson.
Anna Jane Wilkinson. And then when she married Edward Dillon. And coincidentally, her sister, Lillian, married her husband's brother. So sisters married brothers. And there was nine siblings in the family.
Oh, so they were, that was back in Nebraska.
Yeah.
And then when did the Dillons move to California then?
In the 20s, I believe. They settled down in the Manteca area, just out of Manteca, a couple, 3 miles. And were there for years and years and years. I don't remember when I never did know my grandfathers. They both passed away before I was born in 1934. And but both grandmothers survived and for years and years afterwards. And I always enjoyed in the summertime going down to Manteca for a couple of weeks vacation from my family to live with my grandmother, to stay with my grandmother.
That's always fun doing that. I remember doing that myself.
So. Yeah, it was a lot of fun, actually, to get out, go on a working small ranch and stuff. They had to milk the cows every day and feed them and take care of them, let them out into the pasture. And there was pigs and goats and the whole ranch, kind of small ranch kind of thing, where had all the cats and dogs, of course, by the millions, it seemed like.
Now, your grandfather's side was obviously a Dillon, but they came from where?
In England somewhere. I'm not sure exactly where. Like I say, I could find out without too much trouble, but I just don't have it on my fingertips, so to speak.
So at the time that they had the ranch down in Manteca, you were living here in Amador County.
Part of the time, the first 5 years, I lived up in... my dad worked for PG&E, and we lived at a powerhouse called Spring Gap, which is up Highway 108 out of Sonora, near the community of Pinecrest.
Okay.
And it's off, I don't know, it's about 5 or 6 miles out in the boonies. Bear, get down.
Bear spot.
Bear.
Bear spot.
Come on. Yeah.
For the listeners, Bear is a little Pomeranian here.
I got sidetracked there now and lost my train of thought.
No, you were up at the
I was up at
Pinecrest.
I just lost my train of thought totally.
So your father was working in
Spring Gap Powerhouse, right? And when I got old enough to, there was no schools in that area, easily accessible anyway. He asked for a transfer to an area where schools were available, so the PG&E transferred him out to Electra Powerhouse, which is about 8 miles from Jackson, out on the McCallamy River.
Right.
And I lived out there all through grammar school and all through high school, and another half a dozen years after that.
So tell me about that. Your father and family lived at the powerhouse?
Yeah, right. Well, not in it, of course, right. But residences there. There was, I believe there was 13 residences there at one time. And it was all housing for the operators and fellows that worked for the PG&E. And in the process of that, there was, when we first moved there, there was what everybody referred to now as the old powerhouse, which is gone now, and the new one, which is the current Electra powerhouse, the big two-story concrete building that's there now. And I was there to watch the entire construction of that, the big 10 and 12 foot diameter penstock coming down the hill and everything. That was a something for a little boy to, because I was like 10 years old when they started that, more than 10, about 12 or 13, because it started in 1948 and it was finally finished in 1952 when they finished the place there.
Do you happen to have a lot of pictures of that? Did you?
I've got a few, not a whole lot, but I do have some. Yeah, of one of the construction workers. He's 6'6" tall, and he's standing inside of one of these pieces of penstock pipe, and there's still another 6 foot over his head to the top of the pipe.
Now, when you say penstock, for the people who might be listening to this, what is that? What is the penstock?
It's the big the pipeline that comes down the hill. If you've ever been out there to Electra, you can't miss it. It's above ground. It sits on piers, little 40-foot sections of the pipe, all the way down the hill from the top of the hill at. The water comes out of Lake Tebow, actually.
Right.
And then down the penstock, there's roughly 3,000 feet vertical difference, which creates about 1,500 pounds of pressure that
hits those turbines.
Hits the water wheels. And there's big U-shaped buckets, and the water hits the buckets and turns around, and there's probably 30 or 40 of these big steel buckets on two wheels that are connected by a big nearly 24-inch diameter shaft that turns the main generator. And there's three of those in the powerhouse there.
Now, you remember all this from the construction, or did you end up working there? Or
No, I was just a little kid, not a little kid, but a child then. And I just, this was back in the days before OSHA and that kind of thing. I could go down and walk around a construction site, and I ended up befriending one of the big truck drivers that drove one of the dump trucks, because there was a lot of dirt that had to be moved for the excavation site for the powerhouse. And I'd go down there every day and climb up in the cab of his truck and ride with him in the truck all day long.
That must have been fun.
It was.
Now, how many kids lived out there in those 13 families, approximately?
Well, it varied at different times.
Sure.
There was as few as just two or three, and then at other times there was a dozen, something like that. At one point, when we had near a dozen kids there, we technically qualified to have our own school out there, but that wasn't feasible, so we were actually in the Milligan School District, which is up Clinton Road out of Jackson. Due to the geography and things, we were in the Milligan District, but we had to go to Jackson to get to Milligan, so they worked out an inter-district agreement where the kids that lived at Electric could go to Jackson Elementary School and high school.
So was a bus come out to pick you up, or did
yeah,
you have to get
yeah, well,
transportation?
At first, there was one of the mothers of one of the kids there. She got paid by the school district to haul the kids to school, but it ended up getting more kids there than she had car to carry, man, because you know, all they had was just a little Ford sedan.
Right.
And later on, then they got one of these little bobtail school buses that hauled, I think it would take 20 kids, something like that. And then they hired, I don't know how they worked it or how he worked it out, but he was just a senior in high school, but he became our bus driver.
How many kids in your family?
Just myself. Okay. I had a younger brother, but he passed away when he was only 18 months old.
What did your father do for PG&E?
He was the hydroelectric powerhouse operator. They had classifications: first operator, second operator, and he was the first operator. He'd started with the PG&E in 1924 up at the Spring Gap powerhouse that I mentioned earlier there, and it was an isolated area. The only way to at that time the only way to get to it was a tramway down from the top of the hill, or horseback for 3 miles up the river from an accessible area that was downstream of the powerhouse.
Do you know if that powerhouse is still operational?
Oh, yeah.
It is.
Yeah.
At the electric powerhouse, did they run in three 8-hour shifts or two 12-hour shifts?
No, there was when the powerhouse was... once it was built and online, they ran 3 8-hour shifts. It was what they call the morning shift, started at 4 o'clock in the morning and ended at noon. Then it was noon till 8 o'clock in the evening, and the night shift from 8 in the evening till 4 in the morning.
So how long did you end up living at the powerhouse?
All through grammar school and high school, so that's 8 and 4 is 12, plus another 5 or 6 after that. Right after high school, a friend of mine and myself went to Alaska. I told my dad one day, I'm going to Alaska, and I was only like 17. He could have put the kibosh on that in a minute if he'd have wanted to bad enough, I guess, but... He didn't, so we took off within a couple of weeks and drove to Alaska.
Okay, so what did you drive in? And what year was it?
This was 1954. Yeah, 1954. And we drove in my friend Denny Ashbaugh. He had an old 1937 Chevy pickup, and we went up to the high school shop, and Mr. Vire was the shop teacher at that time.
Was that Fran Vire?
Fran Vire, yes.
Fran Vire, okay.
And he allowed us to overhaul the engine and stuff after school hours and stuff. And so we were out of high school, we were out of school at that time, but things were a lot easier then than they are now as far as that type of thing. And he allowed us to overhaul the engine and tune the thing all up and put new tires on it and all that kind of thing. And we checked with the people that owned the El Campo Motel at that time. I can't remember his name right offhand. Anyway, his wife had a sister up there. Their last name was Mayo, and they are relatives of the people that run the Mayo Clinic back in Minnesota. And anyway, we had a destination to go to when we got there.
And that was in what city?
In Fairbanks.
In Fairbanks. Okay.
Yeah. Yeah,
this is 1954. You're driving a 1937 pickup.
Right.
That's just been overhauled. So what was the greatest adventure that you had? Or what was the experience that you remember?
We stopped at the Laird Hot Springs, which is a hot springs. It's right on the Alcan Highway. And we walked back into this. It's about a mile off of the road. And we walked back in there, and as we were walking there, we stumbled across this old grizzly bear. We didn't know what the heck to do. So we ended up just being real quiet, and we stayed facing it, but we just backed away from it. And it just went on about its business, and we ended up not doing a hot springs bath that day.
Now, the Alcan Highway was how would you describe it?
Oh boy, it's almost all paved now, but
right.
Back then it was almost all not paved. Just washboardy gravel all the way. Really wide. I mean, there was no place where it narrowed down to one lane or anything, and trucks could pass. There was a lot of truck traffic and stuff back in those days, but that was before the oil pipeline or anything was
right.
Going on in Alaska there. So
you made it to Fairbanks, no car trouble.
Flat tires, all kinds of flat tires, but when we'd found out ahead of time that you had to have four extra tires, all mounted up and ready to go, when you cross the border into Canada, and we had those, and we had extra car parts and engine parts and stuff like that, so we wouldn't break down in Canada. That was a whole deal with the Canadian people, that you didn't break down and abandon your vehicle in their country.
Right. So you made it to Fairbanks. How long were you there?
I was there for about 6 months is all. And Denny was there for only about five, because we had telephone conversation with our families about once a month. And he found out that he'd gotten his draft notice, and so he didn't realize that you could transfer it up there and everything, so he just beelined home, and I stayed up there for another month and a half after he left, and then I got so, I guess you could call homesick or lonesome or whatever you want to call it, and I ended up coming home too.
Were you working up there?
Yeah, I worked. We both worked for the an outfit called the Independent Lumber Company, and it was just a complete logging operation from trees floating down the river through the sawmill and into the planing mill, and finished lumber that they sold at their retail yard there.
So you came back to Jackson. Then what did you do?
Just kind of kicked around for a while. Then I worked up at the mill off and on during the summertime, and just kind of took it easy for 3 or 4 or 5 years there. Then ended up getting married in 1956 to a girl that lived over here in Sutter Creek, Elizabeth Swift. And
any relation to the current Swifts that are in Sutter Creek?
Oh, yes. It was Ed Swift was her brother.
Okay.
And we lived up on Mill Street. In fact, is when we were first married, we lived in this house where I'm in right now. And then later on, we moved across town to a residence that's in the same lot that Ed's big house is there on Court Street, or not, what's that?
Church Street.
Church Street, yeah, over there. Then we moved back up to what everybody calls the big house up here at the end of Mill Street, where Mrs. Swift lived. Then, because she'd since married and moved to Reno. Then we lived there for quite a few years. I don't remember exactly how long.
So most of your married and adult life then, you've lived here in Sutter Creek.
That's correct, yes.
What are some of the significant changes that you've seen that have taken place here in this town?
It hasn't gotten that much bigger. Although the Sutter Oak subdivision on the road going back towards Jackson, going up the hill, so to speak, that was all developed there. I became a surveyor and by trade, and worked on that subdivision and all kinds of different other projects around the county. I worked for started working for Ledger McMinn. He was a county surveyor at the time, and we worked together for 15, 20 years, something like that.
Now, when you were growing up, both in Jackson and then as a young and adult here in Sutter Creek, all of the mines had closed by that time, had they not?
Yeah, there was no mining going on at all. The only mine that I can remember that was going at the time was one called the Black Prince Mine, and that's up on Tiger Creek Road, about halfway down the hill to the powerhouse.
As a surveyor, when you were surveying, you know, a lot of people walk around Jackson and Sutter Creek, and they see these nice rolling hills sometimes, and little mounds with trees on them, and so forth. You probably know as well as anybody that a lot of those are tailings from former mines. How did that enter into some of your surveying?
Most of the mines and the tailings were still on the mining property, as it is here, right across the way from my house here, up there where those bull pine trees are over there. That's all mine tailings and stuff from the mines around here. There was just a lot of tailings everywhere, because they didn't know once the ore was processed and the gold and amalgam taken out of the soil, it wasn't any good to anybody.
Right.
They had to get rid of it.
Of course, now people consider it an environmental hazard. They kind of flattened it out and built a house on it.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, there was some they up there at I can't remember the name of the development now, but up there by the trailer park, that there's a big flat area out there, and they thought maybe they'd haul dirt in and cover these tailings over and make it work that way. But the EPA nixed that, and it didn't work out.
No. Main Street, Sutter Creek. What any comments about that over the years?
Main Street has just the businesses have changed hands over the years. A lot of the older businesses are gone. Sirocco's, for instance.
What was Sirocco's?
It was a hardware store, grocery store. Anything that you wanted, they could get it for you, kind of thing. That was about it. There was a lot of little antique and gift shops, that type of thing. Where the hotel is downtown now, it was Bellotti's back then, and it was run by Jimmy and Raina Bellotti, and they served. There was a bar in the front and a restaurant in the back. They served really top-notch Italian meals there. A lot of times that was a Sunday destination for a lot of families that lived in town.
Now, you could actually function in Sutter Creek, right, without having to go to Jackson?
Yeah, there was grocery stores and a gas station. Jack's gas station that's now up at Sutter Hill was where the city parking lot is now, right at the Gopher Flat Road and Hanford Street, right on the corner there.
What were some of the activities that occurred during the course of the year that the community would have gotten together for?
Well, of course, it was always the Italian picnic parade in June. That was a big deal forever. It was earlier on, it was kind of a secondary parade to the old Kit Carson days that they used to have over in Jackson. That was a big major blowout for the communities then.
Right. Did you belong to any organizations in town?
No, I didn't. It seemed to me like I was too busy to do anything. Quit working for Ledger McMinn, I went to work for the PG&E in their land department doing survey work and stuff like that, and ended up having to commute to, well, at first Angel's Camp and then ultimately to Stockton, and that just the extra hour each way commute to either location, just plus 8-hour day and a hour lunch, it just ate up the whole doggone day. There wasn't enough time to do anything else other than eat and sleep and go to work.
Now, how was the commute to Stockton on 88?
Not a picnic by any means. I only did that commute for about a year, but I commuted to Angel's Camp for 20-some-odd years. I think I got my groove worn that road.
Now, Highway 49 is probably not a whole lot different today than it was then, other than...
Not really. There was some realignment over between San Andreas and Angel's Camp back then, but that was the only major realignment that went on. Widening out a lot of places, but no realignment to speak of.
Did your wife work?
No, she wasn't able to work. She had a physical disability and stuff where she couldn't work, and she was just a homemaker. We ended up having two boys, Hal is the oldest boy, and Chuck is the youngest one. They both live here on Mill Street now, even. Not very far from the nest, so to speak.
What do they currently do?
They're both into equipment, heavy equipment work and stuff like that. The youngest one is a pretty accomplished mechanic. He can take and overhaul just about anything that you want to overhaul or build anything that you want to build, is for that matter, too. The other boy, Hal, he's got his own Bobcat and does a lot of contract work with that.
So Mill Street has been kind of a Swift Schaefer family compound.
Pretty close, yeah. Yeah, we, like I say, I lived here when I was first married in 56. And, 56. And off and on around here all my life, just about.
Sutter Creek has, I get the impression, hasn't changed dramatically over the years. Obviously, when the mills were operating, things were a little bit different, but the population's about the same as it might have been a number of years back.
Yeah, that's true. There's not that much change from during the, quote, war years.
Right.
And after that, up till the present, you know, there's different people, of course, and that type of thing. But you look through the phone book, and there's still lots and lots of families that were born and raised here, and still have ties here.
Sure. The Swift family is still. Obviously, a relation to your wife's side of the family.
Mm-hmm, yeah,
they're pretty active in the community.
Oh yeah. They've developed the bowling alley for one, and just had their fingers in a lot of different developments around the area.
Now, looking around in your home here, you look like you have an interest in trains.
Yeah, I've got had a model train fetish, I guess you could call it. And I've got a pretty good collection of it, but I've just ended up running out of space, so I had to kind of curtail the collection. Besides trains, I've got some model planes. I've got a bunch of model boats over here, a bunch of model cars. I don't know, a lot of books.
Did you? You never did work for the railroad or have any at all? Just an interest.
No,
just
my dad's brother worked for SP down in Tracy, and he got to when the daylights would come into the Stockton area. They could either choose to go straight on down the valley, or some of them had to turn off and go over towards the Bay Area, and ultimately down into San Jose. And he worked on the switching of those trains when they'd come into the Tracy area.
You used a word, daylights. What did you mean by that?
Well, the daylight was a model of the trains. The top row up there is a model of the daylight. The engine I've got here.
So this is a daylight because it ran during the daylight, or daylight because it had windows in the cars?
It was just because of, I think, of that stripe down the side. They called it the daylight.
Okay.
And the most famous one of the daylights, they've got engine numbers back there where your right thumb is.
Right.
There's
This is 49-49.
Yeah, the most famous one is 44-49, but when I bought that engine, I couldn't get 44-49. It wasn't available.
So what made 44-49 famous?
Well, it was the engine itself had been, when SP took it out of service, they donated it to the city of Portland in Oregon up there. And it sat in a park until 1974. And I don't know exactly how it came about, but it was chosen as the engine to haul the American Freedom Train around the United States during the bicentennial year in 1976. And the engine and the tender were taken and totally refurbished and put back into service, and it's still in service.
And how old would that engine be then?
It was built originally in 1941.
Okay.
So 41, 51, 61, 71, 81, 91, 01, 11. It's over 70 years old.
And it's still operating.
And it's still operating. But it's the only one of that vintage of originally there was something like, I believe, about 50 of these, that type of engine built, and it's the only one that's left. They a lot of them were scrapped during the war. I mean, they were built, you know, in the early 40s, just immediately before the war, and then during the war they were scrapped for metal because the United States was short of metal to build tanks and airplanes and all the other war materials.
When you were growing up in Jackson, and then again having moved here in Sutter Creek, the trains were still operating. Amador Central was operating at that particular point in time. Did you have any relationship at all with the trains? And
no, other than I liked it when I ended up getting caught having to stop it when the train was crossing the highway, and that was about it. I didn't have any connection with the railroad here at all.
Did you ever ride it down to Ione or no. Galt when it was operating in that direction?
No, never did. That was the passenger part of the Amador Central was over with by then. I don't remember when they quit doing the passenger work and stuff.
So it was all freight at that point.
Yeah, I just don't remember. I knew at one time, but
when you were back in high school in Jackson, what were some of the activities that you participated in?
Oh, first couple of years I played baseball. I was too slow for track. Couldn't run fast enough. To make any difference, anyway.
It's an affliction many of us have.
Yeah. Then my junior year, the fellow that was Pat Ryan, that was the what they called the referred to as the athletic manager, kind of pinpointed me to be his follow up when he graduated the next year, and so when I was a senior, I was the athletic manager for all sports except tennis. That's the only sport that I wasn't involved in.
You graduated in what year?
1952.
So have you been to any reunions?
Oh yeah, I've been to every reunion. Well, for some reason or other, our class was a real small class, and we've never ever our class as such has never done a reunion, but we've been included with classes before us and after us over the years and stuff like that.
So your 50th reunion was in 2002 then, and
Yeah, I've got remembrance of all of those here in this stack of these books here. And there was a lot of reminiscing going on there for sure.
I'll bet. How many were in your graduating class?
18. That's a far cry from what it is now by a long shot there.
Do you have any idea how many are still living in the area?
In the area, maybe 5, including myself. There's probably 10 to 12 alive yet, but they're not local residents. They're either within California or even out of state.
Yeah, that's a high percentage considering that's what are you? You're now 80 years old, I guess.
Yeah. Unfortunately, or fortunately, I don't know which.
So, how many years were you a surveyor?
From 54. From 54, and then I retired in just right after the turn of the century, 2001, 2002, something like that.
So quite a while.
A long time, yeah.
So let's just talk about that for a second. You know, when I think of a surveyor, I see, you know, one or two people out with a tripod and some sticks with numbers on them and whatever. Over the years in surveying, in terms of the technical part or the instrument part of it, what kind of changes did you see?
Well, it's changed dramatically there. There's been a lot of changes. Not so much from the transit end of the things, that it's basically still the same, but for distance measuring, the old way was with a chain and plumb bobs, but now it's all done with reflectors and highly technical
GPS.
Yeah, GPS kind of thing, yeah.
So essentially, though, it's still the transit and two guys or two people anyway, because there's obviously women doing it now. But
yeah,
marking from one spot to the next.
Yeah, it's actually you could do a survey with one person now because the reflectors they've got. Tripods that hold those up and stuff like that. It slows things way down, of course, but right. Still it can be done by one person.
What are some of the unique difficulties with surveying in a county like Amador County?
Poison Oak. That's number one almost in my book anyway, because I was so cotton picking allergic to Poison Oak, man. I learned to recognize it real quick.
I can understand that, but it's an answer that surprised me.
And the steepness of the terrain. You get up in the areas up above, up at 3,000 elevation and higher. You get into some pretty rugged country and things where it gets steep and the brush. In a lot of places, of course, with the modern methods, brush isn't a problem because you do it. Everything's measured down from satellites and stuff like that, and you don't have to worry about the brush that much.
Cut your way through it.
But a lot of people still want to know where my property line is on the ground, and that means getting out and whacking the brush and. That type of thing.
And the name of the company that you worked for most of those years?
Was just an individual, Ledger McMinn. I when I was doing private surveying, and then once I got my license and I didn't have to rely on anybody else, I could just go do it on my own.
So you worked independently?
Yeah. And then I worked for years for PG&E, just primarily for the ability to have a 2-week paid vacation a year and sick leave.
Some of the benefits that, of working for a
corporation. Yeah, just benefits of working for a large corporation.
Sutter Creek, you lived here, and then you had Jackson on the other side of the hill, not too far away, obviously.
Mm-hmm.
I've talked to a number of people, and it's almost like they were two towns that were miles and miles apart in terms of the infrequency with which people visited one community or another. How do you react to that statement?
No, that's true, definitely. Because back during my high school years and after that, there was pretty good animosity between the high school students and stuff. I won't say that every time you saw somebody from Sutter Creek, you know, being from Jackson, you put up your dukes and stuff like that, but it seemed like that there was a lot of that went on too, on the other hand. But
so there was a rivalry would be a good word for it.
Yeah, true enough.
In terms of sports. But as an adult, I mean, not so much.
No, not so much at all. That was the rivalry end of things kind of ended there.
When you were married and you were raising children here in Sutter Creek, what would cause you to go to Ione or to Jackson in particular?
Maybe there was more doctor's offices and stuff over in Jackson, bigger stores. Safeway was always over there. In downtown Jackson way back in the 50s and 60s, Safeway was right downtown Jackson.
Right.
Then just the more readily available services there.
Yes, Jackson was more of a commercial center than Sutter Creek was.
Yeah. Sutter Creek was like a residential area. There was businesses here too, you know, but like where Jackson would have, say, two or three businesses of the same type, there was only one over here in Sutter Creek.
In general, over the years, what would you say struck you, if you were to think about it, as some of the biggest changes that have occurred in the county?
When the lumber mill shut down, and they ended up tearing Winton's apart, so to speak,
right.
And then subsequent rebuilding into the mall, basically, that it is now.
So the lumber mill had a pretty big impact on the community, you would say?
Oh, yeah. It employed more people than any other business in the county back then. I think the county's the highest employer now,
right,
for volume of people. But Winton's back then was, I don't remember exactly how many employees they had, but there was a lot of them.
Right.
I mean, it wasn't only the mill, the main mill, and there was a separate planing mill, box factory, the trucking operation. They had like 24 trucks that were strictly logging trucks that hauled the logs from out of the forest down to the mill pond.
Plus all the employees, I guess, it would be out in the forest.
Yeah, all the fallers and the choker setters and, you know, all of that type of thing.
So it would be pretty safe to say that most everybody knew somebody that worked at the mill.
Oh, yeah, yeah. That, very safe to say, in fact, that because just about everybody did, except sure. the county had quite a few people, and the PG&E had quite a few people, but they were the bigger, the two or three larger employers in the county.
And of course, the mill was, as you said, is now up there where Safeway is located, that particular area, mm-hmm. Jack in the Box and McDonald's and so forth, for those who are listening to the tape. But if you were to drive back and forth from Sutter Creek to Jackson, you definitely would know the mill was there.
Oh, yeah, yeah. It was right there on the edge of the road.
I have a mental picture of what it might have looked like. What if you were to describe as you were driving on 49 between Jackson and Sutter Creek, what would be the most dramatic thing that you saw when you looked at the mill?
Basically the mill pond where the loaded logging trucks would pull into this like a little side road. Then they'd get their logs unloaded. They had a system of cables and stuff where the chains that hold the logs onto the truck are all taken off, and then these logs are just basically dumped into the pond, and then they go from they float across the pond, and then they're taken up into the mill.
So there was actually a small lake up there.
Yeah, yeah. It was probably 400 foot square, something like that. It wasn't square, of course,
right.
But that acreage wise, probably 4 acres, 5 acres, something of that nature.
So given what's where that pond was, what businesses are up there now that would be sitting in that pond?
All the stuff that is close to the road there when you first start having businesses there.
So Jack in the Box, Starbucks.
Yeah, that whole area there would have been the pond. And the further off you went past the pond was the main mill and stuff, and that was all in that flatter area that's up there before it starts to fall off down the hill.
So the water tower that's in there would be on the back side of the mill?
Yeah.
It
was on
the highway?
On the back part of the mill. The the shop was back there. They had a mechanic shop there for a mechanic that kept all the carriers, the lumber carriers, the lift trucks, and all that kind of stuff, kept them all operating. The logging trucks themselves were serviced up on Ridge Road, about 2 or 3 miles, 2 miles out of town, on the right hand side up there.
Yeah, that service spot is still sitting there, I believe.
Yeah, yeah, it's still there, right? The buildings are all gone, but where they parked the truck, all the trucks had numbers 1 through about 24 painted into their grills, and they'd come in from the workday, they were just randomly parked, and then the service people got a hold of the trucks in, filled them up with the fuel, checked the oil, and if there was anything that the driver would leave a note, you know, something's broke, fix it, you know, kind of thing, they'd do that. And overnight, and then the next morning, all the trucks would be all parked all in a row, all numerically numbered, all in a row, right along faced on the highway. So all the driver had to do in the morning was report for work and go get his keys and jump in the truck, and you could just drive right out and head up the hill.
Now, you never worked for the lumber mill. You seem pretty familiar with the operation.
Well, yeah, I did work for the lumber mill when I was between my sophomore and junior year in high school, the summer, and then the same from the junior to senior, and then for the time right immediately after high school. I worked in the main mill itself. As a job, I worked down on what they call a dry chain, when the lumber gets unstacked as it comes out of the kilns where it's dried. I worked down in the planing mill. I worked in the box factory. I worked in the whole ramification of jobs that were there.
So was the mill a good place to work in? Did they hire a lot of high school students?
No, not that many. You almost to the point where you had to know somebody to be able to get on. Oops, to get on there.
Do you remember what you got paid?
It wasn't very much. they didn't have back then. The unions hadn't come in there yet. I think it was about $1.50 an hour or something like that. It was, like I say, it wasn't very much. But that was, you know, that was back in the 50s and 60s, too.
Right, right. I remember my first job in 1954. I got paid 25 cents an hour, and I got a raise to 35 cents an hour after a year.
Oh, wow.
So that was back in Michigan. If you made a buck and a quarter out here, you could... California's always paid too much money.
Yeah, that might be a thought, all right.
Well,
yeah, my first job that I had was a bag boy at Safeway.
Well, I have a grandson that's doing that now. So,
oh, yeah. You
know, nothing changes at Safeway. There's always still bagging to be done.
Bag boy and stock boy. After when the store closed they closed at 5 back in those days, you still worked for another couple hours restocking the shelves.
So Safeway was located where then?
Down where the what do they call it? Cal Can is there on Water Street. Where Broadway takes off.
Right.
And Water Street goes out,
right.
And there's the city park.
Right.
Then the next business right there, that big. I understand before that though, it was Safeway started out right in downtown Jackson, where Sammy's Cafe used to be. I don't know what's there now.
It's an antique store now.
Yeah. Yeah, they started out there. When Safeway first became Safeway.
Now the thought it just occurs to me, where the city park is there now on Water Street and Broadway, there was a Garbarini gas station was there, wasn't it?
Yeah, there was a Chevron station.
Chevron station there.
No, it was Standard. They called it then, Standard
right.
Station.
Was Safeway located there at the same time as this? Or did they move there after the service station was taken out?
Oh, no, they weren't on the service station lot. They were on the next lot.
Right.
Over.
But they were both their operation together.
I believe so. I believe they were there together. Yeah.
Yeah. Then most recently, a Coldwell Banker was in that building.
Yeah, that's true.
And now there's a martial arts place in there now. Yeah.
And Safeway went from there... over where Cost Plus is now. Oh no, I'll take that back. They went out, they were out in where True Value was. Then they went to where Cost Plus is. And then ultimately up on the hill where they're at now.
So Safeway's moved around a lot.
Yeah, they have. That's for sure.
Anyway. Anything else that you'd like to tell me about your growing up in Amador County?
Oh, there's things I could go through some of these binders in here and stuff, but it'd be a little drawn out.
So what is in those binders? What kind of things have you kept track of?
Oh, just about any facet of my life, almost. I had this orange one on top. I had access to a whole raft of Caltrans maintenance pictures and stuff back into the 30s and stuff, and that's what that orange binder's all about. There's probably 100 pages in that. I don't know.
Well, there's I noticed in looking around in your home here, you have a lot of things that are of interest, historical interest, and things. I'm looking at a Calaveras newspaper and magazines of California, et cetera. Have you considered making any contributions to the archives or to
society? When I get down to the point where I can't enjoy them myself anymore, I plan to. But the archives have a lot of what I've got already. I've got Jackson High School annuals that go back to 1914, but they've got all of those already. And probably they're just copies, but they're still... I think I know the lady that has the originals, or has originals of a lot of those. I don't know how she came by them, but she was the one that I got all my copies from.
Well, I'm currently the president of the Historical Society, so I always have an interest in collecting things that might be of interest to others in the future for the museum, but. And, of course, we own half of the old Amador Central Railroad, along with a railroad organization. And we have, obviously, an interest in things that are relative to the railroad. But I want to thank you very much for chatting with me today.
My pleasure, actually. I can go on and on and on forever.
I'm sure you can, and I hope to come back and get another... hours worth of conversation with you on some other things in the future. Anyway, appreciate your time.
Well, thank you very much.